Welcome, friends, to the Lucy Davidovich Memorial Lecture of this year, of 2008, could it be? This is Orzarua's 19th birthday, and we are celebrating a week, over a week of festivities, what our president called the counterpart to the Polish wedding is the Orzarua birthday. Just keeps going. The centerpiece is this lecture that we have each year in memory of our late congregant, Lucy Davidovich. We decided many, many years ago that the centerpiece of our birthday should be an academic lecture. And we have had extraordinary lectures throughout the years. And a few, very few, two, have come back because we've invited them back. And Ruth Weiss is one of them. In the very early years of Orzarua, Professor Weiss was then at McGill. And I believe you were still in McGill, weren't you? And lectured, we studied actually a story about Paris. And you taught us that year. And it was just great. And then Harvard got smart and realized that it was the job of a great university to steal some of Canada's great scholars. And so Ruth came to the States, to Harvard, where she is the Martin Peres Professor of Yiddish Literature and Professor of Comparative Literature. Ruth is an editor, a translator. If you've read the Penguin Book of Modern Yiddish Verse that she did with Irving Howe, that's hers. The Best of Shalom Aleichem, the Peres Reader, Shtetl and other Yiddish novellas. Her books are about her academic field of study and then her public role as a public intellectual. You know the most recent, she's been traveling, and we've been reading Jews in Power. If I'm not for myself, the liberal betrayal of the Jews, but also the Schlemiel is modern hero. A little love and big Manhattan about our Yiddish poets. I.L. Peres in the makings of modern Jewish culture. I hope you read Ruth, Professor Weiss in the Wall Street Journal, and commentary. Extraordinary articles. I just feel so good that Ruth Weiss is giving the Lucy Davidovich lecture again. I'll tell you why. Rabbis have unusual, odd experiences of the world. And one of the experiences that is seared in my memory is giving a eulogy at the funeral of Lucy Davidovich. A number of you were there, I remember. And I remember just saying to myself again and again, incorporating it in my remarks, what are we going to do now? Lucy was the great defender of the Jews. The one who was able to retell the story of the Holocaust as a unique Jewish historian, somebody who told the story for all of humanity to know, and they hadn't heard it that way before, but she told the true story. And to me, Lucy was Deborah the Judge, one of our great women defenders of Am Yisrael. And I stood there saying, what now? Who is there Who can take over? Which of our women can be Deborah the judge? Tonight, Lisa Davidovich's lecture is Deborah the judge in my book. It is my great pleasure and honor to call to this podium of Or Zarua on her 19th birthday, Professor Ruth R. Weiss, who will speak this evening on 60 years and counting.
Very, very much. I can imagine I'm very moved to be here, and sure. And thank you for that extraordinary introduction. I can only say that those of you who knew Lucy Davidovich, who had the honor of knowing her, know that she is protesting where she is up there. She did not think that I was her match, and I think that no one ever criticized me as harshly and as devastatingly as she did for some of the things that I wrote. And what I miss most about her actually is that, that there is no one in the world who whose standards were so tough. And that tough-mindedness was indeed what made her so effective and so admirable. It made me love her very deeply. And so I love the fact that I'm speaking here at a lecture named for her, but believe me, I do not compare myself to her. So as Israel approaches its 60th year, I think that we begin by savoring the moment. So there is still a great deal going on that demands our attention. This is a time to take stock of what the Jewish state means to the Jews in the world. We all know that Jews reclaimed their homeland after almost 2,000 years. But we still have a lot of thinking to do about the effects of that transformation. And I'm grateful for this chance to do some of that thinking among friends. So on the fifth day of Iyar, of Tashrinet, corresponding to May 16, 1948, I accompanied my parents to the Montreal Forum, which was the city's largest arena, to celebrate the establishment 2 days earlier of the State of Israel. I was one of the cheering crowd of 15,000 who heard a relayed message of greeting from the first president of Israel, Chaim Weizmann. Passionate speakers in Yiddish, Hebrew, and English assured us of Israel's determination to fight and foretold that the Arabs would very soon accept the justice of the Jewish cause. Most of the details of that program I've reconstructed from the archives, but what I still see in my living memory is my older brother Ben, Olva Sholem, among his friends from Habonim, holding the edges of a Jewish flag that is sagging under the weight of the coins and dollar bills that the public is throwing in, and the sums that were accumulating in flags like it all over the lobby assured me that Israel would be provided for forever. And when I later watched newsreels of Israelis dancing in the streets of Tel Aviv, I felt that I had been party to those celebrations. Around 1888, at about the same age as I was at Israel's founding, Mordechai Zev Feierberg of Novogrodzhbolinsk in Ukraine experienced Zionism of an earlier kind. One night, through a slightly open door, he caught sight of his father sitting on the floor in a corner of the house, the candle in his hand casting a dim light as he chanted the midnight lamentation commemorating the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. And Feierberg writes in a fictionalized version of this, "It was a fearful and awesomely holy scene. The plaintive chant bore into the recesses of the boy's heart and soul. How long will there be mourning in Zion and weeping in Jerusalem?" The old man was secretly crying. Tear after tear rolled down his white beard. "I have set watchmen upon thy walls, O Jerusalem. They shall never hold their peace day nor night. The boy thought of the stories about Jerusalem's walls that he had heard from Jews who had been there. In his mind's eye, he saw two large teardrops fall from the wailing wall while a fox ran stealthily in and out of its breaches. The images of Talmudic legends that he had studied took on shape and substance as Firebird stood listening to his father recite the midnight vigil. The long, bitter exile was not yet over. Jerusalem was burned to ashes. The land of Israel still lay waste. The Shekhinah was in exile, and the Jews lay scattered and dispersed among the nations. Ah, when would the Messiah come? He must come. No, he must be brought. The Messiah wouldn't come by himself, his father had said. Each generation must bring him, and yet so many had tried. They couldn't bring him because the time hadn't come, but perhaps now it had. It was time to try again. The Messiah must be brought. He must, no matter what. Firebird ends this account with the conviction that his generation must move out to the east, to the east. Now, Firebird died of tuberculosis at the age of 25, longing, like his father, for the deserted ruins of a city he never got to see. I, on the other hand, spend time in Jerusalem at least once a year, and I think one of the last times I was there, I saw the rabbi of this congregation with some of the members of this congregation at, if I believe, Olive Restaurant, right? So we have the pleasure of seeing at close hand the development of a buoyant country. And you might be struck by the contrast between Firebird and myself. But I believe that we were formed by an identical attachment, that he was born when Jews were still grieving over their loss of sovereignty, while I was privileged to experience the rebirth of Israel, was just a matter of timing. The generations that wept over the destruction of the ancient temple ensured the eventual return to Zion. Just as the return to Zion rewarded the faith of those who had prayed for its recovery, Firebird and I, and the generation of Jews before us, shared equally in the fate of the Jewish homeland, knowing that it was our homeland. Perhaps no nation was ever more aware of its land, better able to appreciate the blessings of homeland than the Jews who persevered so long out of it. Of course, there are consequences to prolonged separation. A people that spends so many centuries longing for its homeland may grow attached to the longing rather than to its object. The Hebrew writer Shai Agnon worried that far too many Zionists were content to support the country from a distance. And the American Jewish writer Isaac Rosenfeld went further, writing in 1946, "The yearning for Israel runs through the diaspora in no simple sense as of a fixed desire for a fixed object. It is a reflexive desire, turning on itself and becoming its own object. This," he writes, "is the meaning of the passage, 'If I forget thee, O Jerusalem.' The yearning is itself Jerusalem, as in the words, 'If I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy,' and it is to this yearning that the good Jew remains faithful." Now, taking a psychoanalytic approach, Rosenfeld assumed that, like romantic love, the desire for Jerusalem could not be satisfied by the attainment of its object, because the yearning, the hunger, the longing, and the dream had displaced the prospect of actual residence in the city. Now, I think there was certainly some truth to this. Yet 2 years after Rosenfeld formulated this very clever insight, David Ben-Gurion declared Israel's independence. Enough Jews had settled in Palestine to create the infrastructure of a Jewish state, despite the millions of potential immigrants whom the Germans had massacred. Arab armies attacked. Many Jews were killed in defense of the new old land. But the 4,000 uniformed members of the Haganah at the start of Israel's War of Independence had become by the end of it the Israel Defense Forces, 100,000 strong. Accused of going like sheep to the slaughter, Jews began within the same decade of their mass annihilation to build one of the finest militaries in the world. Hundreds of thousands of Jews began returning to the homeland. Children were born there who had never known another place. Jews may have surprised even themselves by the speed with which they built cities, revved up the economy, and created the institutions of sovereign rule. The cumulative commitment expressed by the promise, "If I forget thee, O Jerusalem," would seem to have generated astounding energy. Returning to Zion, Jews proved adept at almost every aspect of running a country, as if they had actually been preparing for it for 2,000 years. So in savoring the recovery of the Jewish homeland, we should also consider that this high point in Jewish history was, I think, no less a high point in the history of nations. In 1945, the United Nations was founded as the successor of the League of Nations. And 2 years later, on November 29th, after prolonged debate, the UN General Assembly lived up to its promise by calling for the partition of British rule of Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state. Jews might understandably have regarded this as being too little, too late. But in accepting the principle of Jewish statehood, the UN had made good the Balfour Declaration of 30 years earlier. Now, the UN had been established, according to its charter, to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime brought untold sorrow to mankind, to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and the equal rights of nations, large and small, to establish conditions under which justice and respect for the obligations arising from treaties and other sources of international law can be maintained, and to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom. No resolution, I believe, ever fulfilled the terms of the Charter as honorably as Partition Resolution 181. Just to recall this a little, Leon Uris' best-selling Exodus, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, devotes 5 pages to the roll call of the General Assembly, punctuating the stenographic record with the reactions of those listening to the broadcast in Tel Aviv. Leon Uris is not the greatest, perhaps, novelist of a Tolstoyan stature, but you can see why people read him so avidly. So here's his description. A solemn quiet fell over the great hall. Afghanistan. Afghanistan votes against. The Yishuv had lost the first vote. Barak, who was one of his characters, marked it on a pad. Argentina. The government of Argentina wishes to abstain. We have to cut the abstentions down, Barak whispered. They could kill us. Australia. Everyone leaned forward as Evatt got to his feet with the first vote of a British Commonwealth nation. Australia votes in favor of partition, Evatt said. A buzz of speculation went up. Weizmann leaned closer to Barak's ear. Do you think it might be a trend in the Commonwealth? We'll just have to count them one at a time. We can't tell. And so on. I wish I could read all 5 pages. Anyway, Uris takes great liberties in this account, such as subordinating Chaim Weizmann to his fictional character and making the affirmative vote of the United States the decisive one of the roll call, whereas the actual outcome was not certain until the USSR and Uruguay had voted in favor. Yet the moral advantage he gives to Israel in the international drama accords with Israel's political advantage that day. Partition was approved by the better part of the world. And I say better part in every sense. Granting the Jews a piece of their homeland fulfilled at least part of the UN's mission to ensure equal rights of nations, large and small. That rare moment of accord between the US and USSR hinted at the welcome possibility of such consensus on other matters. The historian Paul Johnson writes of that decision, "Israel slipped into existence through a fortuitous window in history, which briefly opened for a few months in 1947-48. That was luck or providence." But, and as we'll see, there is usually that but at some point in our national history, 1945 was also the year that the Arab League organized to prevent the emergence of Israel. In response to Resolution 181, the government of Saudi Arabia declared that it does not consider itself bound by the resolution adopted today by the General Assembly and reserves to itself the full right to act freely in whatever way it deems fit in accordance with the principles of right and justice. The representative of Iraq put on record that his country does not recognize the validity of this decision and holds those who were influential in passing it against the free conscience of mankind responsible for the consequences. "We always thought that humanity was a bulwark of peace and a bulwark of justice. Today that faith is destroyed," he said. The representative of Syria declared, "The UN Charter is dead, but it did not die a natural death, it was murdered, and you all know who is guilty." So turning the language of rights against the assembly, Arab delegates flaunted UN authority, warning that they held it responsible for the carnage that they intended to unleash. In fact, the partition plan was terribly unfair to the Jews, granting them a mere fraction of what was left of Palestine after the greater part of it was given by the British to the Hashemite rulers as Transjordan in 1922. This injustice did not go unnoticed, yet Jews hailed the resolution and the Yishuv decided to make the best of it. By contrast, Arab rulers began organizing their opposition to the democratic West in the form of aggression against Israel first and foremost. Opposition to Israel was the unifying feature of pan-Arab politics. It was the vehicle for a politics of grievance against the West and an agent of open defiance of the United Nations from within that international body. The UN ought to have expelled any members that so brazenly flaunted its authority. But this would have betrayed its inability, right at the start, to embrace the family of nations entire. So instead, the UN did a remarkable thing. It decided to pay off Arab debts and to ignore Arab insurrection. It began funding Arab refugees of the Arab war against Israel through UN-administered institutions, thereby abetting the Arab politics of blame and giving it a permanent base in what was to have been the Arab sector of partition. The UN tried to ignore the Arab threat to its authority at the expense of Israel, which was left to fight off Arab invasions, not once, but as we know, repeatedly and ever since. The UN did not intervene on the side of Israel, but for the sake of peace, began subsidizing Arab refugee camps, thereby ensuring not only generations of refugees, but a continuance of the politics of grievance that those refugees embodied. So there are three components to the account that I have just given, and very little has changed in the interim. First, Israel and the Jewish people continue to set an example of self-accountability and mutual assistance. Second, the fate of Israel and the Jews still plays an exceptional role in the community of nations. And third, leading this, the war against Israel and other Israeli attacks are the same Arab countries and some of their Arab allies that initially refused to grant the Jews their equal rights. Today, as then, the most anti-Israel forces are among the most determinedly aggressive in the world. So the question is, then, how is it that one of the smallest nations, numbering, as we do, as Jews do, 4 million fewer than we did in the first half of the 20th century, how is it that this people should continue to play such a central role in the politics of the world? And this is what I tried to answer in book Jews and Power, which could just as easily have been called Jews and Politics. And what I found was really this same tripartite feature that I have just described. And if we go back, what I tried to do in the book is to show how this situation in which Jews still find themselves and found themselves in 1948, how this was, to my mind at least, created. So let's just consider. Jews were militarily defeated very early in their history, first by the Babylonians in the 6th century before the Common Era, then by the Romans in the 1st and 2nd centuries of the Common Era. But unlike so many other conquered nations, they did not disappear from history. I think the main reason for this was that they did not accept conquest. They did not accept military conquest as a judgment on their staying powers. Other nations accepted defeat as an arbiter of their political fate, and Jews obviously understood the difference between conquering and being conquered. But by situating their politics within a transcendent scheme of judgment, they did not have to accept the verdict of the battlefield as final. Their covenant with God made them subject of the King of Kings, which was not merely a metaphor, but it was a precise description of how they understood their relation to the ultimate source of power. God had promised the Jews that he would make them a great nation. He said to Abraham, "To your descendants I have given this land, the land of Israel." God was an exacting judge. Through the Torah at Sinai, he demanded certain forms of behavior and proscribed others. So when the Jews lost their land, the prophets, the Hebrew prophets, interpreted military defeat as the consequence not of the enemy's greater prowess, but of the Jews' failure to please God. So this substituted a triangular for a binary view of political power. Jews were insulated from the vagaries of war because the power they ascribed to God was greater than could be poured over them through military victories. A temporary rout left open the possibility for eventual reversal, just as temporary displacement from the land of Israel allowed for eventual return to it. Isaiah foretold, "For the Lord will comfort Zion. He will comfort her waste places and will make her wilderness like Eden." The more power Jews ascribed to God, the more politically independent they became of the power that other nations wielded over them. And I think that this sense of political autonomy is the main reason that Jews could survive any number of conquests and still feel themselves undefeated. It was this long-term, morally grounded view of national politics that allowed Yochanan ben Zakkai and others to follow the Jewish way of life outside the borders of Israel with the expectation of eventual return to it. After the destruction of the Second Temple, Jews launched what I think is a great political experiment, one of the great political experiments in the history of the world. A nation undertook to live without certain staples of nationhood, without inhabiting their national territory, without any central government, and without independent means of self-defense. Though most Jews no longer lived in the land of Israel, they always knew they had a land, and that they would be returned to it sooner or later, either during or after their lifetime. In place of one central government, Jews had a unifying text, the Bible, which was the source of national history, code of law, system of belief. The interpreters of the law administered a constitutional culture and promoted a self-disciplining way of life based on the teachings of the Hebrew Bible. And then, as a kind of equivalent of what one would call the foreign policy of the Jews, To gain the right of extended residence in other people's lands, Jews learned to make themselves useful. They became masters of economic and cultural adaptation wherever they settled. Jews were flexible, supple, resourceful in adapting to places where they were permitted to live. Because Jews did not have a state, some historians concluded that Jews stood outside of political history. And I have to say that this was pretty much a consensus among historians, including Jewish historians, until the 1970s. But in fact, Jews were highly political as they were religious. Their politics was simply different from, and in some ways opposite to, that of their host nations. Jews developed a politics of accommodation. They made themselves useful to local rulers in return for rights of residence. Under some conditions, to make oneself useful meant money lending, tax farming, minting, banking. Elsewhere, it meant craftsmanship. Jews became weavers, carpenters, glaziers. These are all the trades that are turned into metaphors in the Yom Kippur prayer, Kihineka Fomer V'yad HaYotzer, that likens the material in the hands of the craftsman to the soul of the Jew before God. As much as possible, Jews conducted their own affairs in accord with their own way of life, while politically depending on local powers for protection. Negotiating for favorable status was, as I say, the counterpart of Jewish foreign relations. And I think Yoram Chazoni, in his book The Dawn, takes the Book of Esther as a paradigm for Jewish politics in the diaspora. The combined loyalty and grit and intelligence of Mordechai and Esther managed to secure the ongoing protection of the king. So on the whole, I would say that the Jewish experiment succeeded admirably, remarkably, so much so that by the 19th century, economic and social thinker Werner Sombart concluded that Israel passes over Europe like the sun. At its coming, new life bursts forth. At its going, all falls into decay. Jews succeeded wherever they were allowed to do so, and enriched the societies where they safely settled. My favorite part in writing the book was to consider all the many avenues of Jewish accomplishment. But built into the Jewish political condition was the inability to protect whatever Jews attained or achieved. Jewish leaders negotiated with those in power to ensure the protection of the Jews. But at some point or other, a change of authority, a threat to the kingdom from a foreign attacker, the uprising of a restive underclass, some destabilizing political event would either force or persuade the ruler, who had until then given the Jews his protection, to withdraw that protection, or else even to join the assault against them. Extrapolating from many such historical situations, the historian Gerson Cohen wrote that the safety of the Jews will always depend upon a society in which their interests are guaranteed and maintained, but that any breakdown of the social discipline within such a society exposes Jews to resentment and danger. He pays special attention to populist eruptions against the Jews that rulers and clergy are powerless to check, and he draws his examples from the Jewish community of Elephantine in Upper Egypt, which was destroyed in 411 before the Common Era, the Jews of Alexandria in 37 of the Common Era, the Crusades of 1096, the Spanish riots of 1391, and the Ukrainian pogroms of 1648-49, to show how in each case the Jews were sacrificed by their former protectors to the violence of the mob. Jews had visible power, visible goods to tempt their assailants, but no means of defending that power and those goods once the political shield was withdrawn. And so, rule of thumb, it was always profitable to take over Jewish power and property, and there was never any political cost to be paid for doing so. Jews became a no-fail target. From the Jewish point of view, they thought they were indestructible because a remnant always picked itself up and started over. But from the point of view of other nations seeing this pattern, it was easy to see that the Jews were easy prey. Now, Cohn's analysis stops in 1648, yet in fact, the pattern that he describes became more dangerous at the very point that one was entitled to believe that political progress was underway. Emancipation introduced the idea and the practice of democracy that was supposed to guarantee, like the United Nations, but here to individuals, that was supposed to guarantee equal rights and opportunities to every citizen. Many Jews were, of course, certain that free and open societies would bring their political troubles to an end. They were ideally prepared for the challenges of democratic society, and they put their adaptive skills to use in the professions, in arts and sciences, in commerce and trade, in industry and communication, and so forth. Accustomed to rigorous self-discipline, Jews, for the most part, accepted the full obligations of citizenship. But this wonderful moment in political evolution, and here I have to stress that I do believe it was, of course, a wonderful moment in human evolution, had unexpected consequences. Once upon a time, Jews had only to convince the king of the good that they could bring to the kingdom in order to win his protection. Now, even kings had to satisfy their constituencies. Leaders had to persuade societies of their right to rule. Governments had to explain their actions to the people. Now, nations undergoing emancipation, industrialization, urbanization, democratization, secularization, and all the attendant forms of modernization experienced terrific anxiety. The more successfully Jews adapted to this changed political climate, the easier it was to blame them for its negative effects. And anti-Semitism was a political ideology and instrument forged under these circumstances in the 1870s to attribute the negative effects of liberal democracy to the Jews. Anti-Semitism said that political liberalization had allowed the Jews to use their cunning to infiltrate their countries of residence so as to conquer those countries from within. You see, anti-Semitism was cast as a defensive measure to protect Gentiles from the Jewish world conspiracy. And lo and behold, the politics of grievance, this politics of blame, was as protean as the Jews. The Rothschilds could be blamed for the evils of capitalism. Jewish musicians could be blamed for the corruption of culture. Jewish army officers for sedition. By simpler citizens, Jews could be charged with extracting Christian blood for their ritual needs. But more sophisticated politicians, like the liberal Świętochowski in Poland, could say that every society needs its salt. And until now, Jews have been the salt of Polish society. But that the surfeit of Jewish salt had become indissoluble and would have to be eliminated. So Gerson Cohn had described spontaneous eruptions against the Jews in times of crisis. But modern politics inspired ideologies of Jew blame, and modern communication allowed for an orchestrated politics of anti-Jewish grievance. Now, by the end of the 19th century, many Jews had begun to recognize the inherent dangers of this great political experiment. Some, and I think here are the people who are the descendants of some of those some, lit out for the greater freedoms of America, and others used the example of emerging nation states to call for the reclamation of the Jewish homeland. Zionism concluded, very reasonably, it seems to me, that the Jewish diaspora was the occasion for anti-Semitism. I mean, not that they blamed Jewish politics for it, but it had happened that way. And so one had to recognize these consequences and do something about it. So if Jews demonstrated their political unexceptionalism to other nations, they would be allowed to live in peace. It was high time, as Feuerberg says, it was high time in any case to meet God halfway by, if you know the joke, by buying the ticket, by reclaiming the land of Israel, right? In any case, the Jewish powers of adaptation, which had been honed in the diaspora, were never more in evidence than in the establishment of a Jewish state in, and this is a miracle beyond belief, I think, the establishment of a Jewish state in the same decade as the destruction of European Jewry. And think of how much was involved in that. A people accustomed to urban living created agricultural communities, drained the swamps, made the desert bloom, literally. Jews who had created and spoken dozens of languages realized that in returning home to Israel, they would have to breathe new life into Hebrew, the only language that united all Jews in time and space. And incidentally, this, I think, I'm right in saying, linguists seem to bear this out, this is the only known case in history where a people has taken a language which had served a high status function, had been relegated to a high status function, and brought it back into living vernacular use. There is no other such instance in the history of language. So the settlers of Israel created a home for the entire Jewish people, including the most damaged refugees of the Second World War and those fleeing other lands of oppression. The Jews of Palestine developed the infrastructure of a central government, which the Jews had not had, a system of universal education and health care, orchestras, theaters, commerce, industry, you know the rest. Jews began running a country, as I say, as if they had been preparing for it for those 2,000 years. But Zionists and Jews, I think, and no one could have imagined that the instrumentality, the usefulness of anti-Semitism, the politics of anti-Jewish grievance and blame could be put to use, could be put to work against a Jewish country, no less than it had been against the Jews in dispersion. Arab leaders, however, saw the opportunity, and they exploited it in unprecedented ways. If anti-Semitism had served anti-liberal elements of the political left and right in Europe, think of how much handier it proved for Arab autocrats trying to consolidate and perpetuate their rule and to stave off the advent of democracy. The Jews of Israel, after all, remained a tiny polity in the midst of other nations. They retained the political habits of diaspora communities, wanting to be productive, helpful middlemen, supplying whatever others needed, living among the goyim, among the nations, on the best possible terms they could achieve. Zionists thought that they would find favor in the region by insisting that they did not come with the sword. In fact, the Yishuv was notoriously slow in organizing even primitive self-defense. But as the architect of anti-Semitism, Wilhelm Marr, had said back in the 1870s, the Jews did not come to us as conquerors with the sword. They did not have to. Emancipation allowed them to use their cunning to conquer the new region from within. Arab leaders were concerned about the advent of pluralism, which meant competition, about democracy and liberalism, which meant an end to autocratic rule, and about the advent of modernity, which implied change on every front. They were afraid of precisely the help and the improvement that the Zionists wanted to offer them. So anti-Semitism became the only European ideology that made the effortless transition from Christian and post-Christian Europe to the Muslim Middle East. The Arab League formed, as I said, in 1945 with the specific goal of preventing the emergence of Israel. And it's not just that. It's that the function of that is that it is the common enmity to Israel has been the main feature of pan-Arab politics ever since. Many observers object to conflating anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, protesting that the Arab world is nothing like Europe, that the two situations are nothing alike. Well, this is perfectly true in many ways, but the effect of those differences has been to make anti-Zionism much more virulent than anti-Semitism, because the societies using it are starting from so much farther behind. After all, Hitler had to work very hard to organize and orchestrate mass rallies. Arab leaders use weapons of mass communication, and if you want to watch any of these, you have only to click on something like Memory, the Middle East Media Watch Institute, and you can see Arab movies which are pumped into every single living room, showing you Jews slitting the throats of an Arab boy, holding him over a tub. The blood gathers in the tub, and then in the next scene you see the same Jews offering someone matzahs to eat, and watching with glee as the person eats the matzah and says, "Isn't it particularly tasty?" and so forth. I mean, it is really quite incredible how easy, how effortless it is to spread a kind of animosity that others in earlier centuries had to work quite a bit harder to spread. So I would say that in every sense, anti-Jewish boycotts, for example, were only a sporadic feature of nationalist politics in the 1930s. But the Arab League boycott of Israel and of parties doing business with Israel is now like Israel in its 60th year. And it, too, is still going strong. So Israel's defensive capabilities cannot obscure the fact that by now anti-Zionism has outstripped anti-Semitism in demography, in virulence, in its spread, in everything but its ability to exterminate, and the difference being, of course, the presence of an Israel Defense Force. So the benefits that Jews wanted to bring their neighbors were spurned in favor of the antagonism that they alone could consolidate to that degree. So at this point, you may be saying to me, look what you've done. You started out telling us about celebration, and now you've brought us to despair. If the Arabs so badly need this common politics of grievance, what chance do Israel and its Jewish defenders have against those preposterous odds? And if the international arena is now so much less friendly than it was in 1947, how can Israel win the allies that it needs? And if the Muslim world is now only beginning the reformation and political overhaul that roiled Europe for 400 years, how will the Jews withstand the fallout of that process for the next 400 years? So my answer to that is actually very simple. We can withstand it. The Jewish people can withstand it. The Jewish people must withstand it. And I would say that the Jewish people will withstand it. We Jews have earned our moral confidence, and I think that we have earned the right to celebrate our political sovereignty. For centuries, Jews said and acted on the belief, because of our sins, we were exiled from our land. Now that sense of standing before the perfect seat of justice inculcated in Jews a culture of self-accountability. The habits of self-blame, the habits of self-discipline made Jews resilient and fearless in their willingness to venture out among the nations. I would say that Jewish political behavior was based on this idea of accountability, which is, I think, the most obvious thing about Jewish civilization. But others mistook our moral strength for political weakness. They attacked the consequence of our self-accountability. They took advantage of the politics of accommodation, and they launched the politics of grievance against it. So today we may say, because of our strength, they are trying to drive us into exile from our land. Very different. I think it has been turned around. It is not that we can say because of our sins we were driven. To the contrary, now having shown what Jews were capable of in history, how astonishingly they could live in history, one can certainly say it's because of our strength that we are being driven, or that they are making the attempt to drive us from our land. And blaming their manifold failures and problems on our strength, every day and in every way, evidence mounts that the use of Israel and the Jews as a scapegoat for the crises of modernity in the Arab world condemns those societies to violence and to self-destruction. I think that we should understand that we do Arabs a grave injustice if we assume responsibility for the crimes of their leaders against them. So the stronger our moral confidence and our ability to project that moral confidence, the greater benefit we actually bring to the world and even to our enemies within the world. Our gift to others, and emphatically including our enemies, is to insist on their self-accountability. Johanna Kaplan may be right in a letter that she wrote to me recently. She may be right to say of her generations and her generation, our generation, hers and mine, that we are the last generation able to remember the establishment of Israel as a mess, a moment of trembling, with the radio's UN roll call votes burned forever into our child brains. But consider that after so many centuries, Jews continue to celebrate every spring the miracle of the Exodus from Egypt, which is burned into our adult brains. And we continue to mark every winter the miracle of Hanukkah, and to do so increasingly in the American public square. So it is assuredly up to us to burn the story of Israel into the child brains of generations to come. It seems to me that if we fail at this, we betray not only those who founded Israel, but the nations who acted in unison to sanction its founding at one of the best moments in international history. So, how are national attachments formed? Well, they are formed by words and images. Words and images repeated and interpreted so as to become ingrained. We think that it is nothing to see young children standing at a ball game and singing the national anthem. It is extremely important. The national anthem becomes engraved in their hearts and in their spirit. And I think that it is this kind of engraving that we do when we recite the prayers. I'm sure you do in this congregation, if not in these words, then in others. Our Father in heaven, Rock and Redeemer of Israel, bless the state of Israel, the first manifestation of the approach of our redemption. Shield it with your loving kindness, envelop it in your peace, and bestow your light and truth upon its leaders, ministers, and advisors, and grace them with your good counsel. Strengthen the hands of those who defend our holy land, grant them deliverance, and adorn them in a mantle of victory. Ordain peace in the land and grant its inhabitants eternal happiness. Lead them swiftly and upright to your city Zion and to Jerusalem, the abode of your name, and so on. Now we may wince a little when we ask God to bestow his light on the leaders and ministers of Israel, especially, may say, nowadays. We may think to ourselves, God knows they need it. And we may shudder with apprehension when we ask God to strengthen the defenders of the nation. Certainly we know that they need divine strength. But our awareness, our irony, our awareness of the difficulties that we face as a people should never blunt our capacity to appreciate that we, we of this generation are blessed to live in a world with a Jewish homeland. It is this sense of blessedness that I think we have to learn to express in political terms. Thank you.
Professor Weiss is happy to take some questions. Courage of the real people, come on. Aaron.
Good question. I think I would say much the same thing, that and just say it in putting the emphasis on a different place, putting the emphasis on them. It seems to me that the defense of the Jewish people as the Jewish people is the due north of a political good. That if you want to be on the side of the good forces in politics, all you have to do is to align yourself with the Jews. Why is that? Well, I don't. From what I've said, it seems clear that it's not just because we are so great as a people. No, it's because of the forces that are aligned against us. In other words, the usefulness of anti-Jewish politics has become so great that those politics are ruinous, those politics are destructive, those politics lead to violence, but they are, they don't seem to have any end. So I would say that the UN or any nation can judge itself by the degree to which it resists this kind of temptation. And that's why our role is so important. I think that we sometimes parochialize ourselves because we think that we are defending Jews and we are defending Israel because of ourselves, because, my God, we lest something happens to us. Of course this is our first familial impulse, and so it should be. But at the same time, that parochialism is our universalism, because in defending ourselves, we do defend. We defend the whole politics of self-accountability. We defend the democratic impulse. We defend the openness of the world to justice and to justice for nations small and large and so forth. Yes, one of you.
The metaphor is that sometimes it's the progress of colonialism or apartheid of even American civil rights movement do not justice to the reality of the situation. From my standpoint, I view Israel as the world's greatest national liberation movement. And why have we been so poor in creating metaphors that reflect that reality?
Well, this is really my question. Why? I think that there are many reasons. One of them is this very notion, interestingly enough, I think, in the synagogue where I pray for much of my life, it said over the bima, Dalifne miyata omed, know before whom you stand. And we have this, we built into our way of behaving, our habits of behavior, is this idea of self-accountability. We look to ourselves first to blame ourselves. And we want to, in this political situation, we very much want to blame ourselves. And to me, the explanation looks something like this. That supposing I think that Jews are responsible for the Arab war against us. In a way, this is a wonderful thing for me to believe. Because then all I have to do is to change. I have to just convince my fellow Jews to change. Big deal. I have to convince them, move 5 miles, stop building settlements, do this, do that. And lo and behold, it's a stop. It is such a convenience to think that we are responsible. Whereas, if you see the reality, then what you have to have is a metaphor large enough to insist that you have to stand up to the enormity of the attack against you. You have to stand up to it, you have to deal with it, you have to make sure that you don't get on the defensive, you have to get on the offensive. You have to go to the enemy. You have to take the case to them. This is really very hard for people in any democracy to do. Democracies, like the Jews, are self-accountable. It's hard for Americans to do that, as you see. Nobody wants to go over and take the war to the enemy. Everybody wants to say, well, I just want to be left alone. And in fact, you tend to blame the guy who wants to take you to war, because he's the one who's at fault. If only he didn't want to take you to war, you wouldn't have to go to war. The life would be so much simpler. So finding that metaphor that you're looking for is very difficult. I mean, one of the things I try to say is the simplest thing. The Arabs have 640 times more land than the Jews. Why do Arabs think that they are entitled to 640 times more land and the Jews not to any? Why do the Arabs think that they are entitled to 22 countries and still counting, and the Jews are not entitled to one? Why? Why? I mean, that is the kind of metaphor, if you will, or that's the kind of language I would use, not to try to justify Israel's existence, or even to, you know, but just simply to put the onus on them. What in the world do they think they're doing? Why in the world cannot they accept it? It's an absurdity, really. And unfortunately, we are the ones who have to press that message home. Sir, yes?
You said, how does that find the
Yes, the question is I don't know, I'm about to, for the first time, give this kind of talk at Harvard. Firstly, I don't think anyone will come, except for, you know, people who are committed beforehand, students for a safe Israel or whatever it is. I don't think they will come. I think that the... Well, he is sometimes extremely effective because he undertakes to debate. He makes it, he chooses the dramatic moment, and he recreates a very effectively, I should say, a courtroom situation, a courtroom drama. And the courtroom drama does draw people, and they come to the courtroom drama, and that is, I can't do that kind of thing. I mean, I'm not temperamentally capable of it. And also, what worries me about it is that kind of thing, it's like a debate, so there's this side and the other side, and one is always saying, you know, well, this side will be heard, and that side will be heard, and all the other. I think that the harder thing that one has to do is to really to push. And in faculty meetings, this I have said very often, and I write this very same thing. Don't do anything without a map of the Middle East. I don't want to engage in a discussion about this if there is not a map of the Middle East right there so that we can point to it, so that we can see what we're talking about. That Arabs have 640 times more land than Israel. Now, you explain to me why that should be so. I don't want to explain to you Israel's actions. I want you to explain to me that fact. That's the only thing that I know to do, is to just try to push it back, to say, no, I'm not the subject. I'm not the subject here. I am accountable to myself. That's how I function. Now you have to do the same. You have to be accountable to yourself. It's your problem. does it work? I suppose that if it were done often enough, it would work. And, you know, we are not beleaguered in America. I don't know how you feel. Harvard is one thing, but I don't live in Harvard. I live in the United States of America. And in the United States of America, most people feel the way I do about this subject. Most Americans feel this way about the subject. You're talking to the, basically, you're preaching to the choir. All we have to do is do it more effectively, more often, with more confidence, with more ingenuity, better language, and so forth. But I think that, you know, the question assumes that I am in a beleaguered state, you see, and living that way is not a good posture. One has to live as if we are the majority here, and what we're talking about is the obvious truth. Yes.
How do you explain the trend in the academic circle that makes people ask you if you feel believer? What is the reason that in the past 10, 15, 20 years, there is a surge of anti-religious feelings in large portions of academic world?
Well, it is sadly true, but and there are many reasons. But I would like to emphasize the fact that you know, this is a minority on campus. One should never make the mistake of thinking that this is a majority. Certainly on campuses that I know, sometimes a very vocal minority. Well, one of the things that occurs to me, you see, is that, forgive me, but there's not much left of communism. There's not much left of the left. The anti-Jewish element within the left, which was based on the fact that the left in its classic sense is anti-religious and anti-national, right? It is secularist and internationalist. Now, it is secularist and internationalist against all religions and all nationalities, but it just so happens that it was more so against the Jews, because Judaism was seen to be the ur-religion that it was against, so it was anti-religious, particularly against Judaism. And nationalism, of course, because Jews did not have a country, Jews were expected to be in the vanguard of internationalism. Theirs was the only nationalism which was called reactionary, because after all, the French were already in France. The Russians were already, there were other nationalisms that were already there. Jewish nationalism seemed to be reactionary. So the left was extraordinarily anti-Jewish in both these ways. And this is a terrific problem for young Jewish progressives. And they all come up against it. And there's a certain point where every Jewish progressive on campus has to ask himself, am I going to stay with the progressive, or am I going to go with my Jewish self? And you can see it in student after student. It's a very wrenching for many people. So I would say that the pressure of the left, to be a member of the left, the left is anti-Israel. And for those reasons, that's part of the reason that it does so well on campuses, because I don't think that leftism is quite as popular anywhere as it is on the university campuses. I don't know if that's a good enough explanation, but yes. Yes. Well, it may be that this is something that is said in this. That was not my. That I had said that there were, that Judaism rests on three premises, or on three legs of a stool, the Torah and the land and the people. That was not the tripartite image that I was creating. What I what I used rather was the fact that when Jews were defeated, they did not attribute their defeat to the enemy's greater victory over them. What they said was that they had failed to please God, therefore God had not protected them. So they were, in a sense, independent of enmity. In that sense, a triangle, you see. And that seems to me to be a very empowering kind of idea, metaphor, if you will. I see. Well, that's the can we go on? Well, this is a very good question. I'm not a theologian at all. I mean, it seems to me that I don't know what you mean without the Torah, without some the Jewish law, certainly not. I mean, I think our discipline has to be our national discipline. It cannot be, Jews cannot be just anything. Judaism somehow has to remain rooted in Jewish sources and in the Jewish concept of Torah. In that sense, yes, but I would say that the relationship to God, it seems to me, has changed. And for me it has changed in this way. That God has, I think, has spoken very loudly to my generation. I don't hear the silence as other people hear it. I hear the voice, and it does say what Feuerberg wrote so many years ago. The time has come for you to do it. I think that the relationship between the Jews and God has changed in the sense that one no longer expects God to act in history for us. I mean, I think that we expect to serve God by acting in history on his behalf. And that puts a different kind of political onus on us. And I would say particularly to act politically in a smarter way than we have done in the past. It's to politics that we have to pay attention, to our national politics that we have to pay attention. So I thank you very much.
A few years ago, Naomi and I were at the Hebrew University, the World Union of Jewish Studies, and there was going to be a keynote speaker, and there was several speakers before. One speaker before talked to biblical scholars, very interesting, but it just never stopped. And we were waiting and waiting and waiting for Ruth Weiss. She finally got up and spoke about the Jewish canon. Remember that lecture? We started our book on the Jewish canon, and finally, it was really neat to think about. Friends, you have a lot to think about. We are very grateful to Professor Ruth Weiss for lifting us up on our 19th birthday, and maybe by the time we get to be 20, we'll have figured some of this out, and we'll be straighter Jews, better Jews. That's our job. Thank you very much. Please come downstairs for our birthday party. Please, in the lower level. Go ahead.
Thank you so much. Thank you.